loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, abruptly resigned this morning. The news website Axios, which broke the story, said that the decision was Haley's and that the White House foreign policy team was, quote, shocked, unquote, when she offered the resignation a week ago. Next, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate in Brazil's presidential election, nearly scored an outright victory yesterday, falling just short of the 50% necessary to avoid a runoff. He will now face Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, who finished with 29%. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said yesterday that North Korea is ready to allow international inspectors into a key nuclear testing site, signaling a step forward in efforts to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. Pompeo also said that another Trump-Kim summit was, quote, pretty close, unquote. And then the British online investigative group Bellingcat reported today that it had identified what it called a second Skripal poisoning suspect. The website says that Dr. Alexander Mishkin, a military doctor alleged to be in the pay of the GRU, the Russian military intelligence organization, had something to do with the Skripal poisoning. And while the circumstantial evidence is convincing that Mishkin was somewhere in the UK at the time that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned, there's no evidence that Mishkin had anything to do with it. And finally, renowned Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul over the weekend to fill out a form to register his upcoming marriage. He never came out of that consulate. And now Turkish officials who have received permission to enter the building to investigate are saying that he was murdered by Saudi officials and his body disposed of. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the resignation of Nikki Haley. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, abruptly resigned this morning. The news website Axios, which broke the story, said that the decision was Haley's, not the president's, and that the White House foreign policy team was, quote, shocked, unquote, when she offered the resignation about a week ago. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Welcome back, Jim.
Hi, gentlemen. Nice to be here.
Jim, there's been a lot of speculation as to why Haley did this. She has not said, the White House has not said. The meeting between Haley and Trump this morning was a love fest, where Haley said she was going to continue to campaign for both the president and for Republican congressional candidates. What do you think? And we can get into some of the rumors that we're hearing in a moment, but tell us what your thoughts on this are.
You know, I don't know much more than anybody else does. I read the speculation in the papers, and it is all speculation at this point. One issue seems to come up is that she was being pushed out a little bit from the inner circle of Trump once Bolton and Pompeo came in. And she was very adamant about that when she took the position. I need to be on the National Security Council. I need to be, you know, constantly in the inner circle. And apparently she's been, her influence has been waning somewhat in relation to Bolton. So that's one issue. The other possible issue is apparently she has a lot of money that she owes, and that might be an issue. She's going to make a lot more in the private sector. And then there's speculation that maybe she's setting herself up not for 2020, but for 2024. And maybe she would, there would be some kind of musical chairs where Lindsey Graham would go to the AG or the Defense Department and she'd get his Senate seat, which would set her up for 2024. So it could be any of those things. And we really don't know. What one thing that's definitely not true, and that it's amazing to me that the New York Times says we've just lost a moderate voice of the Republicans, is kind of crazy. And other people, the CNN said she was a voice of reason.
I don't mean to laugh out loud at that, but I can't help myself.
I heard you talking to somebody on the phone earlier today. I didn't mean to like be listening in, but we sit just feet away from each other. So you said you couldn't support the Democrats because they were too right wing.
Yes.
And I fully agree with you on that. But I think the person you were talking to might have laughed, thinking that's
he did. He laughed.
But here's the thing in American politics, Jim, the Democratic Party is actually a center right party. The Republican Party is a center-right, far-right party. There's a fine line, actually, between the right and the far-right and the ultra-ultra-right. It's really a fine line. And in fact, when you think about the U.S., what are you, you're laughing?
And the Third Reich.
Okay, that's the Randy Credico joke. There's a fine line between the right, the ultra right, the right, the far right, the ultra right, and the Third Reich. But yes, that's American politics. I mean, even though Nikki Haley is so right wing, I mean, she's been filled with bombast. She was just like in the cutout of Donald Trump, like threatening to blow up the rest of the world. And she's the moderate voice in the Republican Party. Well, maybe that's where things are.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy, but that's what you get now. I mean, one of the reasons they're saying she was the moderate voice, because she spoke up about, oh, we should believe women and all the women who accused Trump, we should listen to them, et cetera. So that was seen as, oh, man, she's independent of Trump, and she's pushing back on that level. So it's kind of like, how can anybody worse be named? Everybody knows that somebody worse probably will be named. So now she's become the voice of moderation. It's like the Supreme Court, you know. Now Roberts is the voice of moderation. You know, he's the swing vote that everybody has to kind of orient themselves toward, because the court has moved so much further to the right that we just can't say it's entirely right wing, because then you're just demeaning a great institution of the United States. So it's crazy. It's crazy. It just keeps moving further to the right. And the identification of what's the moderate center moves with it.
Yeah, I think that's it. And, you know, the funny thing is, and not funny, haha, funny, disturbing, is that either most people don't realize it, or even if they do realize it, don't really care. I'm surprised at how many Americans are perfectly content to be in a right of center party. And it seems to be at least the vast majority of Americans.
There's no choice. That's the problem. Like if your choices are the right and the ultra right, yeah. then it's, I don't know if it's about feeling comfortable. It's like, I think most people would, at most, let's say tens of millions of people would feel very comfortable in a left wing party that was actually fighting for universal health care,
sure.
and all those other, you know, getting rid of student debt.
Maybe you're right. And that's why we have such bad voter turnout in this country.
Yeah. I mean, because people cannot see and articulate and recognize that there is any other possibility. You know, as you say, Brian, I think if there were someone out there with the same anger and passion as, you know, Trump and Brett Kavanaugh arguing for full employment and arguing for, you know, Medicare for all and universal health care and canceling student debt and telling you why it was possible and necessary to do, well, then everybody listen to that. But you don't get that discussion. You don't get that argument. You get an argument about what somebody did in high school. You know, I mean, you don't get an argument about Nikki Haley is a warmonger. Everybody wants the end to wars. Donald Trump, part of the reason he won, because he said he was going to end wars in American military intervention. He's not doing it, but that's clearly a popular position. And now that he's in power, nobody talks about it anymore. The Democrats don't talk about it.
Yeah, the Democrats don't talk about it at all. Nikki Haley, I mean, in all ways, she's helped mobilize public opinion in the United States, and she's tried globally, but I think she's failed globally to build this case of animus and hostility against North Korea, against Russia, against China, against Venezuela. I mean, against the Palestinians. I mean, she's been like a wrecking ball. But then again, I don't want to emphasize personalities that much, because when you think of Susan Rice, who's now being touted as a possible replacement by Democrats for Collins, because Susan Collins voted to confirm Kavanaugh. Susan Rice was the voice of warmongering when she had her stint at the UN.
Yeah, I mean, this issue, what Haley represented in international politics, which is American exceptionalism, Israeli exceptionalism. John Bolton is saying we're going to go over every treaty and withdraw from anything that requires us to live by the same rules as everybody else, essentially. You know, this has been going on for 16 years at least, and Obama administration made it acceptable policy for the Democrats, so you don't get any pushback on this kind of militarism and exceptionalism. And preparing military actions. If Russia wants to develop those missiles, we're going to knock them out. I mean, this is what moderate Republicans are saying, you know, and it's crazy. And nobody talks about this. This is not a subject of intense debate, even by Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, that's the sad truth.
And it's not going to happen until people start getting hurt by this. You know, they've been made to go to sleep over this issue, over the issues of international militarism and war.
In the last 2 minutes, real quick, there's some speculation, John, about this is just going to lead to a reshuffling of the Trump administration and Republican Party stuff. Like maybe Lindsey Graham, who's a U.S. senator from South Carolina, could be named a replacement for Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense, in which case, well, spin it out. You've heard some of these rumors.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham could either become Attorney General or it could be Secretary of Defense, in which case Governor Henry McMaster of South Carolina could name Nikki Haley to replace Lindsey Graham and then run to fill out his term. Another thing, too, is, you know, there's a story that I heard from a very highly placed Republican Party operative who said that Henry McMaster was literally the first Republican elected official to endorse Donald Trump at the very, very beginning of the Republican primaries in 2016. And at the end of the season, the campaign season, when Donald Trump had won the presidency, the campaign went back to McMaster and said, "What do you want as a reward?" And he said, "I want to be governor of South Carolina." Well, to be governor of South Carolina, you have to get rid of Nikki Haley. And so Haley wanted to run for president anyway. I mean, she's talked about it for years. She had no foreign policy credentials. So what better place to put her than the United Nations? So now, even though she's only been there for 21 months, now she can say she's a foreign policy professional. She can go to the Senate and sit there for the next 4.5 years and wait for Donald Trump to either, you know, lose in 2020 or
he can't run again in 2024.
Reelected and not run again in 2024, so she can run for president. So there are a lot of different scenarios here that are entirely plausible.
We should not forget either the great scenario that we're all looking forward to, which has been mentioned, that she will be replaced by Ivanka Trump.
Well, you know, stranger things have happened, haven't they?
And wait a second, is this a joke or not?
No. This has been in some of the news reports that Ivanka's name has been mentioned as a possible replacement.
I think I'm falling behind the news curve.
You read the wrong news. You come in here every day with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times.
Yeah. And also I read Liberation News, left-wing socialists.
Okay, we have to wrap it up. We were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate in Brazil's presidential election, nearly scored an outright victory yesterday, falling just short of the 50% necessary to avoid a runoff. He will now face Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, who finished with 29%. We're joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Aline Piva. She is a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. Welcome back, Aline.
Thank you.
Aline, this was a tough one. I think everybody was surprised that Bolsonaro came so close to 50% and the Workers' Party did so poorly with only 29%. I have some friends in the Workers' Party who tell me that the far right, not just the right, but the far right was energized in this election and that even members of the Workers' Party have been disappointed that it doesn't seem to stand for anything in this election other than we're not the right wing. How do you see this election?
Yes, it was very new. You know, everything pointed to the fact that we would have a second run between Bolsonaro and Haddad. But we were hoping for, you know, a not so immense gap between the candidates. I mean, Bolsonaro had almost 20% more votes than Haddad. But there are more things to it. There was a lot of voters that didn't turn out, that, you know, voted blank, that annulled the vote. Because what is going on is that we are seeing a process, and it's not something that started in this election. It's the result of years of anti-politics, of empowering most reactionary sectors of the society. And, you know, the prospects are pretty grim. Since 1989, there wasn't one election where the candidate who won the first round for the presidential elections lost the second round. So it's going to be a tough fight. Not impossible, though. You know, we can reverse those votes. We can bring more people to the polling vote, to the polling box. But it's going to be a tough fight.
Aline, let's just try to help us understand and help our listeners understand. what the dynamic is here. The Workers' Party of Brazil, under the leadership of Lula and then Dilma, has won four elections in a row. Four. So you can't do that, and we can't observe that without the idea, hey, Brazil is a progressive country. Not you know, comprehensively progressive, but it's got a left-wing tradition now. And yet the left suffered this surprisingly small, you know, vote in the first round, and the fascist Bolsonaro, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but we're using the term fascist, I think, not in a rhetorical sense, but in a real sense in terms of where he's come from. Maybe he would have to move to the center because of the parliamentary system, maybe. But here's the thing, is that it reminded me of the dynamism of politics. And I've been reading a lot in the last, you know, weeks and months about what happened in Germany. We're a very progressive country. The working class in Germany voted communist or socialist almost in its entirety. The fact, you know, up until 1930, 31, 32, the fascists were small. And then suddenly the fascists appeared to be like the voter's choice, not immediately, but it was the sudden
ascendant.
Yeah, a sudden turn of events where they had all the momentum. Anyway, let's just talk about why this phenomenon is playing out right now, and if, in fact, that's an appropriate analogy. It's clearly not a perfect analogy, but just whether it's an appropriate one.
It is. I think there are two dynamics at play here. On one side, there are the history of Brazil. We need always to remember that we lived under a military dictatorship that ended a little less than 30 years ago. So we have a very recent history, you know, democratic history. We made a conciliation process back then. We never fully made people who, you know, the military and all those responsibles for those atrocities pay for that. There is one side, and that legacy is still alive. It's still alive, and that's where Bolsonaro takes his strength. On the other hand, I think we live a dynamic much similar to what happened in Trump's election. We are seeing his people, Bolsonaro, gaining from the economic scare, from the red scare, from fake news. I mean, this wasn't a political campaign. This was a campaign based on lies, on inflaming people's fears and hatred for the left and care for their well-being and all the similar things that we saw happening in the U.S. in 2016. And the thing is that the left has been responding very badly to it, because we tend to point out how heinous he is. And all these things that would sound to us something that would disqualify him is exactly what makes him strong with his base. You know, when he say things against women, against LGBT community, against the black community, that's exactly what made him strong with his base. So it's very complicated, but I see similarities, including I heard rumors, I'm not sure, but Stephen Bannon was working with Bolsonaro's campaign team, might have some Cambridge analytics on that as well. The similarities are uncanny.
Aline, I'm going to ask you to make a prediction. Let's say that Bolsonaro wins. What then vis-a-vis the military? What's the role of the military? What does the military see as its role in a right-wing government, especially in light of the fact that Bolsonaro has been courting the military and has spoken fondly of a time quarter century or so ago when the military was actively involved in Brazilian politics?
Since 2016, when Dilma was legally impeached, the military has been regaining space in the civil society. They are now, you know, holding posts in the government. They are serving as consultants for the Supreme Court and things like that. There was an empowerment of those sectors in the society. Bolsonaro's vice president candidate is a member from the high rankings of the military. So there was a longing within the military ranks to go back to be a part of politics in Brazil. And that's exactly what is going to happen. And we must all remember, you know, Brazilian military is very, very reactionary. So not good.
Yeah. And there's another element of what's going on. We see this in the United States with the Trump campaign. We see it in Brazil. And again, going back to the Germany analogy, and I'm not making the idea that right now the United States is on the verge of fascism or something like that. But I have this point, is that Hitlerism and fascism or these ultra-right politics are not simply the police forces or the military. Maybe more the case in Brazil, actually, because of the role of the military. There was a populist element to it. There was a part of the population that was enlisted. That's what gave it energy. It gave it sort of this right-wing campaign and also gave it the capacity to impose terror methods against its opponents, where, you know, you were beaten up if you were wearing like a social democratic or a communist shirt or insignia in Germany in the 30s. Is there a reign of terror that's starting to intimidate leftists in Brazil? Do we see some of that?
Yes, absolutely. Sunday, just after the polls were closed, a community leader in the state of Bahia was assassinated just because he said he voted for the Workers' Party. A couple of days before the elections, a member of the LGBT community in the south of the country, was killed just because he was walking on the street and people knew he was from the LGBT community. There are plenty of examples. What we are seeing is not, it's similar to what happened in Venezuela in 2016. You know, there is a strength of this violent actors, but the difference in Brazil is that it's not a concentrated act. It's diffusing throughout the country. But for example, when you look to the assassinations of the attacks against leaders of traditional black communities in the country, there was a surge of 350% in the assassinations of black community leaders. It's a trend that's been going on. And it's not only black and LGBT, but all kinds of progressive in the countries. We saw throughout the campaign, people who were, you know, campaigning for the Workers' Party or other progressive parties being outright attacked, not only by members of the civil society, but also by the police.
That was the voice of Aline Piva. She's a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. Aline joined us from Caracas, Venezuela. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said yesterday that North Korea is ready to allow international inspectors into a key nuclear testing site, signaling a step forward in efforts to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. Pompeo also said that another Trump-Kim summit was, quote, pretty close, unquote. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Good to have you, Simone.
Thanks for having me back.
Simone, I've gone over the U.S. press today, and they all say essentially the same thing, that this is a great leap forward. Pompeo did exactly what was needed. Trump and Kim are going to meet again. But there's really no meat to this, it seems. You know, this supposed agreement for international inspectors actually isn't an agreement. It's just kind of a good faith sop, I guess I'll call it, to the U.S. side saying, yeah, you know, we'd like to continue down the right road. We'll allow these inspectors in at some point. I'm just not seeing any meat on the bone of this meeting. Are you?
I think that the main, the biggest point there or accomplishment is to basically to reset the SALT negotiation, as you know, between United States and North Korea. I think that was the big issue, as you called it, since the Singapore summit, not, you know, many things happened. And in the meantime, we had all these federal hardliners and neocons and also skeptics and the people who are, who have negative, you know, perspective on the, even the process of dominating the media. So I think there was the president, you know, President Moon's amazing, you know, accomplishment in my view through the Pyongyang joint declaration, you know, his third summit in Pyongyang. So he basically helped to reset that stolen negotiation. I think that in itself is a big, I think to me, sort of a big, big success. And the second, if you look at, although as I agree with you, there aren't really specifics. The fact that Pompeo, this was his fourth visit. As you recall, when President Obama's, it was even to get even one meeting with North Korea between United States and North Korea was a big, you know, it was a big challenge. So the fact that Pompeo made a fourth visit, I think in itself should be a good news. And apparently, what I heard that he met with Kim Jong Un, Chairman Kim, for more than almost like 6 hours. So they discussed, and we don't know all the detail, but in fact, they really had a very very in-depth discussion. And so there, one concrete thing is there is that the possibility, in addition to having those international inspectors, what I'm hearing is North Korea might have also promised the dismantling permanently the Yongbin nuclear facility in the presence of international inspectors. This, if it happens, it is a big deal because you know that to dismantle the huge 5-megawatt plutonium production reactor, although it is somewhat old, it's still, as you know, fully operable, is a very big deal. So I think many serious analysts point out that this is a very, very positive signal. I think North Korea, Chairman Kim probably promised that. And also Chairman Kim most likely have given a very, very satisfactory promise to Pompeo about halting the North Korea's ICBM program that is actually, you know, bigger threat than a bigger threat as a nuclear threat to the United States. So probably, you know, promise something like formally dismantling that program. So in exchange, we didn't see all the details, but some kind of easing economic sanctions and also agreeing on the declaration of an end to the Korean War. So I agree with you. There aren't a lot of specifics, but I think that the very fact that to reset this stalled negotiation, it ought to be something we should celebrate.
Yeah, I agree with Professor Chun. I think it is a big deal because of the length and the duration of the meetings. You wouldn't expect the DPRK to actually say in great detail in a meeting like this exactly how everything is going to unfold.
Sure.
They're also looking for reciprocation.
Well, and that's the question. So what is the reciprocation? The U.S. press never mentioned anything that the U.S. was conceding.
Yeah, and that was the point of the foreign minister, North Korea's foreign minister, when he spoke at the General Assembly. He said, if you expect us to unilaterally disarm, forget about it. We're not doing that. But we can find a way to go forward. And the way forward is reciprocation. Step-by-step reciprocation. Now, let's just think back. Let's say somebody just tuned into our show and haven't heard this before. I want to remind people, North Korea unilaterally declared a moratorium on its nuclear weapons test. It unilaterally declared a moratorium on its ICBM tests. It had a very high-profile explosion or blowing up of at least the opening of one of its nuclear facilities. It shut down a missile engine production site. It released Americans who were detained in North Korean prisons, three of them, It sent the remains of Americans killed during the Korean War. At the same time, the North and the South have attempted to go forward with, based on reciprocal relations, building an inter-Korean railroad, which the United States nixed, using the aegis of the UN command at the DMZ. They've also said that they want to integrate North and South Korea at different levels. They're trying to demilitarize the DMZ. Even though it's called the demilitarized zone, it's probably the most militarized part of the planet. I mean, these are big things that North Korea has done. And now I think the North Koreans are still saying, we'll make even another concession. We'll let international inspectors in, still, though, not naively going to go forward with their own unilateral disarmament, which, of course, would be a grave error for any state that was in the crosshairs of the United States.
Exactly. And one thing that we for sure is that North Korea, as Ri Yong-ho's UN speech, made it very clear, North Korea is never going to disarm unilaterally. And I just like 2 points about what you said and also the latest development. One thing it seems to me is that the United States, at least Pompeo, is shifting toward more incremental, actions. It seems the United States no longer wanted to insist on the very, speedy process and denuclearization, immediate denuclearization. So it seems to me they really kind of agree with in North Korea for more incremental, words for words and action for action, a sequential approach. So that's what I'm hearing, that there's some progress in favor of North Korea. But you are right. And what I see, what North Korea wants right now is really some kind of immediate sanctioned relief. And that will be interesting whether United States Trump is going to be, willing to give. And if there's no substantial relief, US-led a sanction, at least I think North Korea, especially I think also South Korea, both Korea, want some kind of a rollback of sanctions. Is that enough to permit, this is we're talking more like inter-Korean collaboration. As you already pointed out that, UN command of the United States has been also trying to have an obstacle in inter-Korean reconciliation. So for instance, I think there's 3 things, resuming Kaesong Industrial Park, resuming Mount Pyongyang tourism, and also, all the financial logistics that involved to create opening permanent venue for family reunions. I think South Korea will request the exemption on UN sanction that facilitate those inter-Korean reconciliation. So there will be like some small project, a small but important step. But nevertheless, I think that North Korea does want some kind of sanction relief from the United States as part of, in adding this more sort of proactive initiative that it has taken.
Simone, let me just ask you, because we're down to about 90 seconds left. China and Russia both voted for the sanctions at the UN Security Council, very severe, draconian sanctions. Clearly, Russia and China both want sanctions to be eased on North Korea. They want to have more goods and services coming to North Korea. And yet they're bound by their own earlier decisions. They would, in some ways, if the U.S. vetoes any sanctions relief at the Security Council, they would have to bilaterally open the door to North Korea, even if the U.S. is chastising them as busting the sanctions. They'd have to do that. Of course, they could do it. They're both major powers. Will they do it?
I think that they will do it. And also China has already been lifting some sanctions. And we have noticed that. And one last thing I want to tell you, that I went to Global Forum on Korea last week in New York, and I met with the many North Korean diplomats. They want, my impression, they want one thing, foremost, implementing the number one of the Singapore summit. That is, having the basically normalizing relations with the United States. That is their single most important goal. They said that is what they want, and then if everything can follow from that. So I think that's probably North Korea's the biggest right now, the goal, to have a normalized relationship with the United States, no longer end the 70 years of enmity. Yeah.
That's really important, John, because just think about it. China has normal relations with the United States. Russia has normal relations with the United States. They're pretty sour right now, but they're normal.
Yes.
A country could have nuclear weapons and still have normal relations with the United States.
As both Pakistan and India do.
Yeah. So it's not like some great anomaly. It's really about a decision that Washington has to make.
This is completely political. We're going to have to leave it there, though, Brian. We were joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. Simone is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The British online investigative group Bellingcat reported today that it had identified what it called a second Skripal poisoning suspect. The website says that Dr. Alexander Mishkin, a military doctor alleged to be in the pay of the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Organization, had something to do with the Skripal poisoning. And while the circumstantial evidence is convincing that Mishkin was somewhere in the UK at the time that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned, there's no evidence at all that Mishkin had anything to do with it. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, good to have you.
Excellent to be with you again.
Alexander, I went through this entire report, and it's quite extensive. And at the end of it, I said, so what? None of this made any sense to me. And they don't actually come out and say that this Alexander Mishkin had anything to do with the Skripals. They say that Alexander Mishkin came to the UK on a false passport under a different name. He's in MI6's database of GRU officers. Okay, so what?
Well, indeed, so what? It seems to me that we have now, I think, hit the low point of utter absurdity on this case. I mean, there is an official investigation which is supposed to be carried out by the British police, which has identified two suspects against whom the police say they have a certain amount of circumstantial evidence. And then we have a completely parallel amateur investigation carried out by a blog, which goes around making all these extraordinary allegations, very unprovenanced in the case of the first about Colonel Chupiga, this frankly rather inconsequential allegation about Dr. Mishkin, and of course that is the investigation which seems to be getting all the attention, even though, I mean, one should put the words investigation there, it seems to me, in inverted commas. I mean, I've never known any situation like this before in any kind of investigation of this kind taking place in Britain.
Yeah, it's one. Bellingcat appears to be one guy.
Well, that's right. I mean, clearly he's, as I said, I think we've discussed this before, he's obviously getting quite a lot of help from various sources and various people. He claims to have this connection, but I'm sure he does have a connection with this group called Insider Russia, which I have to say I know very little about, and I would be rather skeptical that they have any great access to any privileged information in Russia. But as I said, at the end of the day, we're talking about an amateur. We're not talking about a professional investigator, and we're not talking about someone who actually has direct access to the investigative material. So why people are giving him so much attention absolutely escapes me. And yet, if you read the newspapers this morning in Britain, it's all assumed that this man is telling the truth, that Elliot Higgins, aka Bellingcat, aka Moses something or other that he called himself once, he apparently is the oracle that we all go to.
Yeah. Bellingcat, John, by the way, comes from the medieval fable about mice who discuss how to make a cat harmless by putting a bell
around his
neck. So it's Bellingcat.
Bellingcat.
So it's this guy, Elliot Higgins, who he used to, was it, what was his other name? Moses?
Brown Moses, I think.
Brown Moses, yeah. So he's got a new name. And somehow he's able to find his way through all of the GRU and Russian military yearbooks.
Mm-hmm.
So is
that's what he did.
Yeah. So like he went, somehow this guy has like the capacity to go through thousands of photos, archival photos, and do matches between these two individuals.
Well, he did that. And he also said that he had sent emails to everybody who was at this school that this Mishkin was supposed to have gone to. Only two people responded. And one said he didn't know him. And the other said, oh, I remember him. He was in a different class than mine. And that was enough confirmation to call this guy a GRU officer.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Go ahead, Alexander. Then I want to ask you a follow-up question.
It's exactly the point. This is not how proper investigators work. And it was the problem with Elliot Higgins is that what he is actually doing is the exact opposite of what true professional investigators do. He has a theory, and he's simply looking round for evidence that will, in his own mind, confirm that theory to be true. And, of course, if you want to approach an investigation in that way, you will always find evidence that is true. The problem is that is not how investigations work. No police investigation works in that way. In a police investigation, you work outwards. You start with an initial crime. You identify your suspect. You try and contact your suspect, and you try to question them. Something, by the way, which I think is possible in this case. We should not forget the Russians have been offering to cooperate with this investigation. It is the British who are saying no. And then, once you've accessed the suspects and you find out more about them, then you're able to move forward. It is the diametric opposite of what Elliot Higgins is doing.
Yeah, and again, Elliot Higgins, John, also made his claim to fame about the war in eastern Ukraine, Syria. I'm looking at the media. Elliot Higgins started a blog under the pseudonym Brown Moses, through which he published his research into video footage of the Syrian civil war. Now, again, we're talking about a guy, a person. He's in the UK. He looked at hundreds of short clips, John, on the internet. He localized them and examined details of weapons used. As a result, Higgins was able to demonstrate that the Syrian regime was using cluster munitions and chemical weapons. I mean, that's the same. In other words, every time the U.S. or the U.K. want to intervene somewhere and talk about chemical weapons, somehow this magical, all-powerful Elliot Higgins guy is the man.
And it's just some guy in his basement.
Yeah, and he can go and he watches YouTube videos and says, based on careful examination of these YouTube videos, I now have proof that the Assad government used chemical weapons. How convenient. And then the U.S. government and the U.S. media and the U.K. government and the U.K. media, they don't have to quote themselves.
Right.
They can quote this independent researcher, Bellingcat,
right,
the guy who tried to put a bell around the neck of the cat to make it harmless for mice. I mean, the whole thing on its face is such a fraud.
It's a complete fraud. I mean, can I just say, I mean, let's just take a step back and consider how absurd what you just outlined is. I mean, it's not as if the United States and Britain and all the other Western powers don't have in their militaries and in their intelligence agencies huge numbers of analysts who are going through all the material that's coming out of Syria or wherever and making analyses, real analyses of who is using what weapons in Syria based on actual intelligence. And yet, we are being directed again instead to this person, Elliot Higgins, and people say, you know, he's independent, so what he says must be true. I mean, it is completely absurd. And the way this person has been built up into, as I said, some sort of oracle, some sort of authority, is ridiculous. I mean, anybody, if I may say so, going back to his ability to spot particular weapons, anybody can go through all these extraordinary magazines that we have in Britain and the United States and elsewhere and check Jane's or whatever it's called and compare photos, and we can come to all sorts of conclusions. Are we experts? Well, I am not, and I'm sure he isn't. And one shouldn't give any kind of credence to people of that kind who are not experts. And one should look instead to real experts, people like Theodor Postol, in connection with the original East Ghouta chemical attack, which Higgins was so involved in, and people of that kind.
Bellingcat also gets donations from Google.
Uh-huh.
And Open Society Foundations. That would be, of course,
George Soros.
Anyway, go ahead, John. You were about to jump in.
I noticed also that Scotland Yard refused to have any comment on this at all. Is that because it has come to them from left field, or is it because it's a policy of theirs to just not comment on an investigation?
Well, I think it is exposed to some extent. I mean, in the sense that what Scotland Yard, the police themselves, are doing is they're only commenting on actual evidence that comes their way. This isn't evidence. Just like John said, you go through all of this material that he throws up, and actually, it isn't evidence of anything. So why should the Metropolitan Police comment upon it? If you want my own opinion about the police, and as I said, the police in Britain is an agency I've known for quite a long time and fairly well. I think not only are they not impressed by what Elliot Higgins is doing, I suspect they're very angry with what Elliot Higgins is doing, because not for the first time, he is an amateur investigator meddling in the conduct of a professional investigation. And what those sort of people do is they throw out false clues, they send people on all kinds of sidetracks, and of course that is exactly what the police doesn't want to get itself involved in.
Alex, again, I want to emphasize for our listeners that the Russian government, aside from all the media clamor, both, I would say both in Western media and to some degree in Russian media, but the Russian government is willing to cooperate for an actual investigation. They have not yet been asked by Britain, though, for cooperation on a police investigation. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it goes actually further that they have repeatedly offered to the British cooperation, and the British have repeatedly rejected cooperation. The British won't even share basic information with them. So if, as I said, the British really wanted to arrive at the truth and wanted to find out whether these two suspects were innocent or guilty, then obviously they would cooperate with the Russians, as the Russians are offering, because that is the only way to get to the suspects. And without getting to the suspects, an investigation like this can get nowhere. And that's obvious.
We're going to leave it there. That was the voice of Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran, and he joined us from London. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Renowned Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul over the weekend to fill out a form to register his upcoming marriage. He never came out of that consulate, and now Turkish officials who have received permission to enter the building to investigate are saying that he was murdered by Saudi officials inside and his body disposed of. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's an anti-war and anti-torture activist who's the co-founder of Code Pink. Code Pink has organized a protest tomorrow at noon at the Saudi embassy here in Washington. Medea, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Medea, even as recently as a couple of years ago, I would have said, if you told me that a journalist as important, as prominent as Jamal Khashoggi, who writes for The Washington Post and The New York Times and the International Herald Tribune and is renowned for his integrity and honesty around the world, had gone into a Saudi embassy, was murdered, and probably chopped up because they didn't like his op-eds, I would have said you were crazy. But now Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud is the crown prince, and it seems like anything can happen. What's your take on this?
Well, I agree with you. As much as they have been doing that, it's so crazy internally of throwing dissidents into jail for blogs and making satire punishable by 5 years and executing people for nonviolent crimes, doing this in a NATO country like Turkey with a U.S. resident and, as you said, a prominent journalist does seem beyond the pale. So we don't know yet that this is absolutely what happened, but it sure looks like it. And it's just raised to a new level and actually forced people from President Trump and Vice President Pence to Mike Pompeo and Republican conservatives to start saying, we better do something about our relationship.
You know, I was struck also by the response to Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance on Twitter. As you said, even Mike Pence tweeted this morning. He says, deeply troubled to hear reports about Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. If true, this is a tragic day. Violence against journalists across the globe is a threat to freedom of the press and human rights. The free world deserves answers. Chris Murphy, a senator from Connecticut, says if this is true, that the Saudis lured a U.S. resident into their consulate and murdered him, it should represent a fundamental break in our relationship with Saudi Arabia. It's unusual for senior officials in both parties to come together, although Pence's statement could have been stronger. It's unusual for them to come together.
Well, he could have mentioned the word Saudi Arabia.
Indeed, he could have mentioned Saudi Arabia, and he could have said, you know, he could have threatened a break in relations like Chris Murphy did. He didn't do that. But do you think that if all the indications are that Khashoggi was murdered inside the consulate, do you think that there really will be some kind of a break in our relationship with the Saudis? Or is this just lip service and window dressing until the whole thing blows over?
I think something's going to have to happen. I saw that Rand Paul just said he is going to force a vote on weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. I think it's just way too embarrassing. There was even a very good tweet by Marco Rubio saying that this was unacceptable and should cause a reexamination of relations. So I think it's beyond the pale. I think you're now getting to the point where they just can't push this one under the rug like they can the death of Yemeni school children or the kidnapping of the prime minister from Lebanon or throwing the women activists in jail. This is too much. So I actually think it's going to lead to, you know, maybe even symbolic, like the temporary cutoff in weapons. But more important, I think it's going to lead to some kind of internal coup inside Saudi Arabia. I think the royal family is seeing that this guy is out of control and that before it goes to the point of a break with the West, they better show that they can rein him in.
Madia Benjamin is our guest. Mohammed bin Salman, the real power now in Saudi Arabia. When he came here, Madia, I mean, you and others protested, but he got the red carpet treatment, not just
from the
Trump administration, but from Harvard, MIT, Disney, Oprah.
Henry Kissinger, Michael Bloomberg, Morgan Freeman, Richard Branson, you name it. And yes, there were a handful of us protesting it at whatever location we could come across. But it was absolutely disgusting. And I spent the day yesterday tweeting at all of them, including the 24 PR firms and law firms that are in the pay of Saudi Arabia that go from Hill and Knowlton to Hogan Lovells, all these big companies, Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, and asking them, we want to see your statement. What are you putting out about this disappeared journalist? So far, we haven't gotten a reply.
Madia Benjamin, there's a lot of talk about meddling in American elections. It seems to me that the Saudi royal family has also been historically very close to the Trump team and close to the Kushners and Jared Kushner, of course, Trump's son-in-law, but the Kushner real estate business. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors about investments in, but I think it really is about Saudi investment in the U.S., whether it's in Trump-related businesses or all the businesses that the Saudis have poured money into, and of course, the close relationship that these all have with the Trump administration. And that goes from the Wall Street companies, the high-tech industries, you know, both Uber and Lyft get Saudi money. So their money is spread all around. You know, they also own the largest oil refinery in Texas. You look into just so many different areas of the U.S. economy and Saudi money is in there.
Yeah, John, and when you think about it, Trump, the first trip abroad was Trump went to Saudi Arabia.
First trip.
And promised $110 billion, not in aid, but arms sales to Saudi Arabia. But that was, Madia, that was the exact number that of weapons that were sold during the 8 years of the Obama administration. So it also, as you're pointing out, stretches, it's not a Republican thing or a Trump thing. It's, even though Trump is a thing and Trump and Saudi Arabia are a thing, it's bigger and broader than that.
Well, yes, and we've got to talk about the weapons seriously, because this is a massive amount of money that the Saudis are paying for U.S. weapons, and the weapon sales have been dictating U.S. policy. I mean, the fact that the U.S. is involved in Yemen at all is because of weapon sales. The fact that the U.S. has this cozy relations with the Saudis is not even so much about oil anymore. It's about the weapon sales. So can we really allow our government to have a foreign policy connected with this vicious dictatorship because these weapon companies are making profits from it? I hope that this is a time when our government will be forced to reevaluate this.
Mendia Benjamin is exactly right. We've transitioned into a permanent wartime economy, and a lot of people, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, have grown very, very wealthy working for the likes of Northrop Grumman and Boeing and other defense contractors that deal only in the weapons of death. So, Mendia, with that in mind, how are we able, or how do you think we can shake our elected leaders to go back to an earlier policy? And, you know, the policy really has never been great when it comes to Saudi Arabia. We've always sold them weapons and we bought their oil. But how do we get it to a point again where it's not normal, where it's not acceptable to sell weapons and rockets and drones and fighter jets to be used against civilian populations in wars of choice? How do we shake Capitol Hill to go back to something that's a realistic foreign policy?
Well, first we have to bring this into a left-right coalition, the Republican and Democrat coalition, so that we get people like Mike Lee and Rand Paul, and now we have to get Marco Rubio, and we have to get Bob Corker before he leaves, and to come out and say, all right, we're going to put a hold on these weapon sales. And then the other problem is we have no grassroots base. You know, there are almost no Saudis in the United States willing to speak out because they live in fear. And it's been very hard with a weak anti-war movement to get more than 20, 30 people out to protest in front of the Saudi embassy. And when we go to Capitol Hill and lobby on this, we have a weak coalition of groups. So it's all got to be strengthened. And let me throw Bernie Sanders into there, because he's been very good at trying to bring this Republican-Democratic coalition together, and people like Ro Khanna on the House side have been doing it. So I think, unfortunately, the disappearance and probable murder of Khashoggi is going to give us this push right now to take this to a new level and force at least an immediate freeze on those weapon sales, and then a reexamination of other ways that we must impose sanctions on Saudi Arabia.
That was the voice of Mendia Benjamin. She's an anti-war and anti-torture activist who's the co-founder of Code Pink. Code Pink has organized a protest tomorrow at noon at the Saudi embassy in Washington. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.